So you recently passed with the group of six people that the Crown Prosecution Service dropped a case against regarding the Ratcliffe Power Station action. Would you like to say a bit about what happened?
Well, I suppose going back to when it all started, which was Easter of 2009, so nearly 2 years ago, people gathered from all around the country. There was a plan to shut down Ratcliffe Onslow Power Station just outside Nottingham. The aim was to shut it down for a week and prevent, I think it was 150,000 tonnes of CO2 emissions that would have been released during that time if the power station had been operational. I'd been asked a few weeks beforehand by somebody I knew if I would drive some people from Sheffield to somewhere within 3 hours of Sheffield, so that could be anywhere from Carlisle to Snowdon to Norwich to London, really. So we didn't know where we were going. I think there was a core group of people who had been arranging the action and knew what the plan was, but most people had just been asked if they could clear the decks for a week. We turned up in Nottingham at the Iona School, and over the course of the day there were briefings about the action. It was the first time that most people got to hear what the plan was, and people were offered to take it or leave it in terms of participation. People were asked to remain in the school if they weren't going to go on the action, so that they didn't go and spill the beans somewhere, have a casual conversation in the pub that was overheard by some power station worker or something. So, yeah, people were due to leave in the early hours of the morning to go to the power station, and sometime around midnight or so, a few hundred police turned up at the school and smashed their way in, despite people being about to let them in with keys, and arrested everybody. And then about three quarters of an hour later, they arrested a bloke asleep in a van outside, which was me. Then,
so how many people?
There was 114 people arrested.
114.
So we were held. A few people had their houses raided while we were in police custody. People taken to various police stations. It was sort of a combined operation between Nottinghamshire and Derbyshire police forces. And I can't remember the exact ins and outs of the arrest. We all got released around about that evening, I think. We had a debrief, sort of crazy chaotic meeting at the Sumac Centre afterwards, trying to establish what to do from there. I had to recover one of the vehicles, the minibus I'd hired from the police pound, and drive people back to Sheffield as well.
So, I mean, what was that meeting like? I mean, you said chaotic, so...
The post-arrest.
Post-arrest. People were shook up, scared, not particularly, or...
Hard to tell, because there's no sort of no planning for it, for a meeting like that, and lots of things to cover, like regaining property, and people also sort of drinking and trying to calm themselves down. So I can't remember sort of hanging out with mates, and there were people there from all over the country, and some old friends of mine who used to live in Sheffield who moved away who were there, so it was a bit of a social catch-up as well as a crazy post-arrest meeting, and trying to sort out logistics like getting the vehicles released by the police before the pound shut at 5 o'clock so people could actually drive back to wherever they'd come from. And the vehicle I had, I ended up taking it back a day late to the hire place, and they were frantically trying to call my mobile phone, which was in police custody, wondering where their minibus had gone, because my plan had been to drive some people to Nottingham and then drive back to Sheffield. I think some plans were put in place in terms of communication from that point onwards. I think we were all bailed to reappear at the police station about a month later, which we all did. I think it was spread over a week, the bail dates, because of the number of us. I think they interviewed us all there. We thought at the time everyone had given a no-comment interview. And then I think we had a second return to the police station, and then they dropped the charges against maybe about 60 people.
So why did they do that?
They'd never given any indication as to how that was done, or what criteria they selected people.
They're all charging the same thing in the first instance.
They've changed the sort of system that they do. They don't charge you now when they arrest you, because the police have got such a shoddy record of getting that right. So they just bail you, and they hand the file to the Crown Prosecution Service to decide whether a charge had come, because apparently about a third of charges
like when the police hand the fire light to the CPS sort of break down sobbing, going, why on earth have you done this? So that's a system change within the last couple of years, I think.
Yeah.
I think maybe initially there was a criminal damage aspect to the charges, but what they settled on was conspiracy to commit aggravated trespass, which is a bit of a weird one. I don't think...
It's a thought crime, essentially, isn't it?
It is. I don't think until our case anyone has ever been convicted of it. But aggravated trespass is a very minor charge which would normally be dealt with in a magistrate's court. But because the conspiracy aspect, it had to be dealt with in a Crown Court, but still had the same very limited maximum penalties. I think 6 months in jail and a handful of £1,000 fine being the absolute maximum available. Crimes with that level of punishment would normally only be tried in a magistrate's court. So the case rumbled on, and then a few months later, another sort of half the remaining defendants had the case against them dropped, which left either 26 or 27 of us. And we arranged a defendants' meeting, which we had in London, and at that first meeting, we weren't sure whether it was 26 or 27. And yeah, Mark Stone, we weren't sure about. On one list he was a defendant, but on the solicitor's list he wasn't. So we found somebody who knew him quite well, and they said, no, he's definitely not. He's definitely had the charges dropped, and he's in America. So it was like, so we just sort of carried on. I started quite a lengthy process of defendants' meetings. This sort of started in January of last year. So there were 26 of us trying to get people together from all over the country, and really trying to work out what we'd do in terms of decision making if one or two people weren't there, which seemed almost inevitable with the number of people. So a group of people, some of whom knew each other, there was a handful of people there I knew very well, but a lot of people that I couldn't say I'd ever seen before. And so trying to build up that trust to be able to say, okay, if I'm not at the next meeting, I trust you guys to make a decision for me. I think we did that quite well. And yeah, we had a series of meetings over the course of last year, and there were various legal issues to be considered. And there were two sort of main things, main lines of defence that were coming up. There was at least one person who was adamant that we should be charging the, as you said, the thought crime aspect of the arrest, the preemptive of arrest, and he was like, this is what we should be challenging, whereas I'd say a majority of people wanted to argue that their actions were justified, the actions that had been planned were justified because of the damage that the carbon dioxide emissions from the power station would have caused. So there was a bit of tension, and then there were some other people who just really didn't want to get found guilty. I class myself as one of those. That was my main thing. I never intended to go on the action in the first place, so the idea of a many weeks long trial sometime down the line really didn't appeal very much. So we ended up sort of splitting into two groups. One group decided that they were going to argue that their actions were necessary to prevent the deaths, specifically the deaths in developing countries, low-lying countries that are being attributed to climate change currently. And I think there are various other arguments about sort of damage to property or future damage that the emissions would cause, but to have been found not guilty, the deaths was the only thing that would really have the weight.
So they were pleading not guilty, but...
They were pleading not guilty. Yeah. They weren't denying there was a conspiracy. They weren't denying they were part of the conspiracy, but they were saying that the conspiracy was necessary and that any right-thinking, rational person in possession of the fact, there'd be a reasonable way for them to act.
A similar thing to the Smash EDO, Charlie Ryan.
It is. There's a difference. I'm not the best person to speak to about this. There's a difference between a justification defence, which I believe the EDO people ran, and a necessity defence. It's to do with the charges.
Okay.
But yeah, I'm not the best person to go into the sort of things there. But yeah, justification defences have been used successfully on occasion.
Yeah,
the EDO thing you refer to, the Greenpeace activists at King's North a few years ago, and then going back to the women who disarmed the Hawk jets in the 90s. And every now and then it happens. But the first hurdle for the necessity group was to get a judge to actually allow that defence to be heard. There were legal arguments, and the Crown Prosecution Service were arguing that shouldn't be heard, and it should be a simple matter of were they conspiring. And I don't think our legal team were too optimistic that the judge would actually allow that defence to be run, but he did. And the way it worked out, because that was quite a sort of non-tangible thing. Our legal team thought that trial would happen first, and then the people denying being part of the conspiracy, who were the remainder of us, would happen second, which is how it turned out. So the case eventually came to trial. I think it may have started in November. It ran through a lot of December of last year. So that was already sort of 20 months after the arrest. So it's a long time for people on bail. It's a 3-week-long trial. Again, I'm not the best person to speak to. I only made it down to one day of it, and that was a day when the jury were deliberating, so I didn't see any of the courtroom stuff, but they had some very hard-hitting witnesses for the defence. Caroline Lucas, the Brighton MP and leader of the Green Party. James Hansen, who's NASA's leading climatologist. And I think George Monbiot appeared. And for the necessity, they had to try and prove a number of things. They had to prove that the deaths would have happened, that climate change was a real threat in that regard. And the prosecution didn't really argue with that. So then the main arguing block was whether the democratic process in Britain was sufficient to deal with the nature and scale of the threat posed by climate change. And that's where people like Caroline Lucas and Alan Simpson, who's recently stepped down as an MP for somewhere in Nottinghamshire, he'd been an MP for 10 years, and they spoke about the democratic deficit and how our democratic system in Britain and globally systems aren't able to deal with the nature of climate change, and how citizens need to take action for themselves. This was the main thing. So Felicity Gerrit, who's the prosecuting barrister, basically used arguments like, well, you should have flown David Beckham to the Cancun climate talks, used the £15,000 that he spent organising this action to do that, or had a celebrity no drive Tuesday campaign or something.
These were actual examples.
Yeah. And she pointed out that she had a compost toilet at home, which the judge told her to shut up and be relevant. And, I mean, from everything I've heard, it sounds like Felicity Gerrit, for the prosecution, virtually given up by the end of the case, and the judge's closing comments were so leaning towards an acquittal that people were pretty shocked when the jury came back with a guilty verdict. I don't think it helped that it snowed during the trial, and 2 days of the trial were postponed because of snow. And I think the people sometimes see colder weather and go, oh, climate change isn't happening, we must be going into an ice age or something, and the full complexities of the altering climatic patterns aren't that easy to convey to people, and definitely not in the simplistic way that mainstream media deals with these sort of things. So yeah, they were found guilty.
Was that the whole of the... Was that a majority verdict of the jury?
Yeah, the jury deliberated, I think, on the Friday after... They were sent out on the Friday afternoon, about 2 o'clock, and they came back at 3:30, 4 o'clock, and asked the judge if they could go home, and it looked like they'd had a big falling out. And then they deliberated all day Monday, and about, I think, early afternoon on the Monday, the judge called them back in and said, look, I've asked for a unanimous verdict, but I will now accept a majority verdict of 10 to 2, but I'm not going any further than that.
I mean, you know, it's interesting when you talk about it, but the whole, will the judge allow us to defend ourselves in this way? Mm. Oh, go on then, I'll have 10 for 2 if you're in for it. You know, it's quite interesting, isn't it, to sort of see that side of... Yeah. Justice and these kinds
of structures. Yeah, I mean, that is their structure. They, like, you can't be found guilty on a 9-3 split. And if they hadn't been able to resolve it 10-2, then it would have been a mistrial, which I don't think anybody would have been happy with, because it was a big commitment from people to be in court for 3 weeks. But the interesting thing was the jury then came back with a unanimous verdict, even though they'd been deliberating.
Interesting dynamics going on.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I mean, the trial would have been quite interesting. It was a bit of a set play, the whole trial, because the prosecution have to say, disclose their evidence to the defence beforehand, and vice versa. You have to give the outlines of your case. And the only really interesting thing, to me, would be the jury room deliberations. Mm-hmm. And they should get rid of Strictly Come Dancing and X Factor and show jury room deliberations on reality TV, and that would be TV worth watching.
Yeah. So you're selling film rights?
Not personally. But yeah, so going back slightly in time, so that case was concluded mid-December, and our trial, the six of us, so that was 20 people found guilty, all arguing the same defence. They have 3 barristers representing them, 2 junior barristers, a QC. But back in October, Mark Stone, as we knew him, Mark Kennedy, as he turns out to be, was exposed by some people who knew him as being an undercover police officer, and this became fairly public news fairly quickly. I think I knew about it within 15 hours of it being exposed. So this threw up big questions for us about, well, we now know how they knew about it and knew to raise, but how does this play into the court case? Lots of legal opinions, but also because the six of us who were...
Did the 20 use it at all in their case?
No. They decided that it would be a distraction, and they didn't think that it would be particularly relevant because they were admitting that they had planned to do this action and that they thought that that was the right thing to do. They didn't see any way that that would particularly help and could only serve as a distraction. But yeah, so they only had three barristers between the 20 of them, but the six of us each had our own barrister. We all had the same solicitor, Mike Schwartz and Bynum's, who's been absolutely brilliant through the whole process and still is being, in fact. So we decided that we would see if Mark Stone Kennedy could be any use to our case. And one of the defendants contacted him and had a phone conversation with him, at which he stated remorse at what he'd done and said that he might be willing to help us in some way and that he would speak to our solicitor. Now, I think I'm right in saying he didn't return our solicitor's calls, and when the person spoke to him again, he said he'd changed his mind about being in any way cooperative and cited concern for the safety of his family as the reason for doing so.
Who do you think was threatening him at that point?
He's a professional liar, so we can't believe anything he says. It may be been threatened, maybe he hasn't, I don't know.
But I find it hard to believe, to be honest.
Yeah. What our legal team decided on then is interesting. One of our we had a meeting in London with, there was four of us defendants and all six of our barristers, and trying to sort of get our heads around the options with it. And one of the barristers pointed out, well, the big courtroom drama would be to drag Mark Kennedy into court and put him on the stand. But he said, it's like throwing a hand grenade into the room. You don't know where things are going to go, where it's going to land. But what the course of action we decided upon was that our legal team wrote to the prosecution and said, look, we know you've got an undercover, you have an undercover police officer. We think this is relevant to our client's defence. You have a duty to disclose all relevant information, whether you're planning to use it or not, and whether it undermines your case or not. So please tell us any information about it. And it was quite well worded, like about 12 paragraphs saying all that, and then the 13th paragraph said, and by the way, if there were any other undercover police there, we would like details about that. And it took them a little while, I think that was the 10th of December, it took them a little while to respond. Our trial was supposed to be starting on the 10th of January, and they responded and basically said, no relevant information. So our legal team got together another email, which was really well worded, and basically cited abuse of process and quoted about 20 pieces of case law that were relevant, and it was like really hard hitting. And the final paragraph again said, and if there were any other undercover police officers, you really need to tell us about them. So I think that was submitted on the Wednesday, which would have been the 5th of January. On the Friday, the 7th, the Crown sent an email to us saying, new evidence has come to light which substantially undermines our case, and we're not proceeding with the case against you. Which, I mean, I got a phone call lying in bed and big cheer, that was very good. So, but we still had to go to court, and I don't quite understand that, but so we went to court on the Monday, and in the meantime Newsnight and The Guardian somehow got wind of them dropping the case. Like the Mark Stone Kennedy thing had been run by some press.
It was back an article in The Times.
It was on Indy Media first, and that was, it was picked up on by, I think, The Times and The Telegraph maybe ran a little piece on it as well. So it was out there. But hadn't been taken up majorly. So I think, yeah, The Guardian and Newsnight picked up on it, and some of our defendants were very keen to try and manage how it came out in the press, and Newsnight wanted an exclusive, so there was a lot going on with managing it, and we were asking The Guardian not to run it until the Tuesday edition, so Newsnight could run it on Monday night. The Guardian put it on their website Monday night, put it on Tuesday, but they ran it a day early for some reason, which actually worked really well for the press interest, because the Guardian ran it on Sunday night on their website, so I think all the other press agencies picked up on it, so they had people at court on the Monday. And I expected on the Monday the court to be really interesting, because I don't know if you've been in court much, but particularly Crown Court. I've never been to public school, but I imagine it's a bit like a public school room. The judge is like a public school teacher, and the barristers are like pupils, and he's not afraid to tell them off in a very belittling way. And I fully expected the prosecution to get a severe telling off for just suddenly dropping the case, and for some awkward questions to be asked of them as to why they've done it. But I also expected the defence to cop some flack for it being on the front page of The Guardian, his case, before he's even sat it. So I thought, this is going to be great to sit back and twiddle my thumbs and watch highly paid barristers getting told off. And the judge didn't say boo to a goose. He didn't ask why the case had been dropped after 20 months. He didn't question the defence as to why this case had appeared in all the media, or on the front page of The Guardian anyway. And it turns out that, I think, is it Keir Starmer, the Director of Public Prosecutions, was in Nottingham Crown Court that day. Apparently completely unrelated.
He hangs out there.
Yeah, I mean, they get come out of London a lot, don't they, for these things. I mean, my assumption is he went and said to the judge, don't ask anything about this, just let it go. So we came out of court, and there was lots of press there. It was run live on BBC News 24, lots of other press. Mike Schwartz, our solicitor, made a really good statement, and then some of us did various interviews, and it was a bit of a press bonanza for a couple of days. Still rumbled on, really, with all the repercussions and the exposure of other, albeit former, undercover police officers, but that's been quite useful, I think, for a number of people in terms of getting closure. It's very difficult. If you suspect someone as an undercover police officer, you can't say anything unless you can find absolute proof. So I think with both the woman in Leeds and the guy in Cardiff, there were people who had really, really strong suspicions, but not enough grounds to go public. So The Guardian somehow got the police to admit that, yes, these people were undercover police, and I think that's given some of the people involved some closure. It's like, okay, yeah, we can move on from that.
The way the media initially ran the story was that he'd gone native, as it were.
Yeah.
Which,
surprisingly, the mainstream media don't tell the truth.
Yeah,
and the phrase that was often...
So where did that story come from, do you think?
Well, I mean, the phrase that was often repeated in conjunction with that was that he'd offered to give evidence on our behalf.
That was
all over the place, and that was the reason why the case clapped.
There was a recorded phone call as well, wasn't there? On Newsnight, I think there was a recorded
phone call. I've referred to that phone call already. That was the first call between one of the defendants and him, and he said that he may be prepared to help us in some way, but that's very different from saying he would appear in court and support our version of event. Yeah, I mean, it sounds like a juicy news story, doesn't it? Undercover cop goes native. And I suppose the fact that he expressed remorse about what he'd done, whether that was genuine or not, maybe leads to that angle of it, but what goes on in the mind of the mainstream press is not really something I want to understand. But, yeah, it was interesting how they painted it like that. But the crux of the matter was that the six of us who were denying being involved, some of us were denying planning to go on the action, and some were saying that they hadn't yet made up their mind when they were arrested. So to be part of the conspiracy, you have to have actively agreed to be part of it. And if you haven't made your mind up yet... And the main prosecution argument was going to be that we all knew before we went to Nottingham what we were going to be doing, which just isn't the case. So if he had appeared in court and testified the truth, then that would have supported our version of events and the fact that the briefings were given at the school and people didn't know in advance. We were a long way from a situation where that was going to be the case, although that's what the press did largely report. So
in the second interview, I mean, the first interview is rumoured to have got a six-figure sum for the Daily Mail, and then in the second was it Sun Mail on Sunday. And in the second interview, he said that he'd had a recording of the meeting done on a £700 Casio watch, and that that was past the evidence that wasn't... If that evidence had been disclosed, it would have backed up your case as well. Is any of this true?
I don't know if he had a
did
secret
you see
James Bond.
What kind of jewellery was he wearing?
Yeah, I don't know. It's quite possible if he was at the briefings, he was working undercover, then it's quite likely that he recorded them. So yeah, I mean, in terms of why the case collapsed, I think there's two possible reasons. The reason stated in the media isn't the reason, because that's not true. One is that the police didn't tell the Crown Prosecution Service that there was an undercover cop. This is one of the theories that's out there. So the Crown Prosecution Service only found out about it.
I'm reading it in the Guardian.
Well, no, they dropped it just before that, but they hadn't passed on the full information.
Yeah.
And the other one is that there's information that they don't want to reveal around the undercover cop or further undercover cops who are still serving.
Yeah.
Because if you look at the people who've been exposed.
There's a lot of people that charges were dropped against.
There are, I mean, yeah, but if you look at the undercover cops that have been exposed, they've all been no longer serving, and the budgets for this sort of thing have only been going up and up and up over the last 10 years or so. So to think that there was only one... Mark Stone Kennedy claims that he was no longer a police officer at the time he was exposed. Again, he's a professional liar, so whether or not that's true... But if it is true, there were no currently active undercover police who've been exposed during this process. So it's fair to assume, looking at how many there were active 3 years ago, that there's at least an equivalent number active as of the start of this year.
Yeah.
And yeah, maybe one of them was involved, who knows? It seems quite likely with the 114 people, but...
Yeah.
So, yeah, I think there's definitely information that they regarded as too valuable to let out.
And one thing I was wondering is to what extent had he been involved with the idea of the action or the planning of the action or the actual logistics of the action, i.e. to what extent was he acting as an agent provocateur or to what extent was he just kind of tagging along with it?
Yeah, okay, I'm not the best person to answer this because I wasn't involved in organising it. What I believe is the case is that he was involved quite early on in the planning process and acted on one occasion as a driver to go and have a look at the site and actually suggested some ways into the site. Because he lived in Nottingham for most of the time he was undercover and Radcliffe on Soar was just outside Nottingham. So he was definitely in on the plan well in advance. I don't know how central he was to planning it.
But did he do the recce before the action was supposed to take place? Where he went, there was some police at the power station and he went to recce on his own, came back, said the coast is clear. This is a story I've heard.
Yes. There were police, I think around 24 hours before the action was supposed to happen, there were quite a reasonably visible police presence at the site.
Mm.
And I think people, from what I've heard, people were on the verge of calling off the action.
Okay.
And he went and did another recce and reported that the police had gone. And so things
coast was
carried on. So yeah, I do believe that's true.
That's kind of agent provocateur in a way.
Yeah, we were talking about it the other day, weren't we, about... You know, there's a secondary repercussion of state agents, which is everybody gets fucking spooked.
Yeah.
You know, which is incredibly useful.
Yeah.
You know, it has a kind of suppressive effect.
Yeah, I mean, I think infiltration's to be expected, and an attitude I've had for quite a long time was assume everyone's a cop.
Yeah.
And if I just assume everyone's a cop, then I won't spend any time bothering to think whether anyone is and being paranoid.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So, should two people have gone to do the wrecking? In a sense, I'm just thinking of, you know, how do you cope with thinking, oh, well, everybody's a cop?
Two people could have gone, they could have been
both cops.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, what about the meetings in Europe where, you know, most of the British representatives around G8 staff were cops?
I mean, that sounds pretty bad, doesn't it? I think there's some work being done by some people trying to repair some of our relations with our continental because of the snow.
There was one article on Indie Media from some people in France, and it was, you know, written in quite bad English. But yeah, had we know that, you know, it appears that almost every actress that comes from Britain is a cop. Is this the case? You know, how can we know if
people? Yeah. No, it's understandable, especially, yeah, it sounds like it was at least one G8 meeting where it was just Mark Kennedy and the guy from Cardiff who were representing Britain. And, yeah, I mean, they've got the time and they've got the resources to go travelling around, I suppose, haven't they?
Did he come to Sheffield for the G8 stuff? He's obviously active in Scotland, that's been out, but...
I can't remember, to be honest. I don't recall him being here.
Wiki thing with a chronology.
There is, yeah. I don't think he appears on that.
Yeah, there's no mention of Sheffield on that. There's no mention of the M1 widening, which he might or might not have some involvement in.
I mean, in terms of the court case, I mean, things are still ongoing in terms of our case, because with the charges being dropped against us, there's now a big question over the convictions of the 20, which has been looked into.
And it's very much the community service people ended up with?
Yeah, I mean, the sentences were remarkably light. The judge, when he was passing sentence, commented on them, and people had submitted character references, and he said he'd spent a long time reading them, and that he said the words that I keep coming across from reference to reference are well-meaning, intelligent, good-natured, and he said that these, as far as he can tell, these people acted from the highest possible motives. And as I've already said, his summing up, people really thought was leaning towards an acquittal. So, yeah, 18 of the people were sentenced at the same time. Two of them were on prearranged holidays. And of those 18, 13 got, I think, conditional discharges, and the other 5 got community service between 60 and 90 hours. And I think one person got a £500 costs award against them, and one person got a £1,000, which is based on their savings. So yeah, remarkably light sentences. But yeah, the Crown have appointed a QC to look at the safety of the convictions in light of the new evidence that exists.
Or the evidence that they won't release.
The evidence that they won't release, yeah. And I think it's, yeah, the possibility of an appeal by the 20 or some of the 20 is still there. So yeah, it's not definitely, doesn't seem to be over yet.
Yeah.